interesting at this point. And thank you again, everyone, for joining us in the first Keystone Policy Series. When grantmakers of Western Pennsylvania and Philanthropy Network Greater Philadelphia put this together, our goal was to try to inform Pennsylvania's funders all across the state about how some of your colleagues are working on selected statewide policy issues. We wanted everyone to have the opportunity to hear about work being undertaken by Pennsylvania funders that's directed at a certain policy challenge. We wanted folks to learn about potential solutions and roles for philanthropy, discuss best practices for funders who want to engage in advocacy, and also build and strengthen the connections between funders all across the state. So today, this webinar is focused on education advocacy, and we'll be hearing from a group of funders, a leading advocate, and a consultant as well. Our speakers today are Kristen Burns, who's Associate Director with Grable Foundation, Michelle Figler, Vice President of Learning at the Heinz Endowments, Ann Thompson, Education Program Director at the Endowments, Elliot Weinbaum, who is Great Learning Program Director at William Penn Foundation, Melinda Fine with TCC Group, and Joan Benso of Pennsylvania Partnerships for Children. So to start, we know there's no single right model for a successful advocacy campaign. However, there are some strategies that funders can consider that would strengthen the likelihood that a campaign can be successful and that your grants will ultimately have the impact that you intend. TCC Group recently carried out an evaluation of what makes advocacy campaigns work effectively. So before we talk with panelists who are actively supporting education advocacy, we wanted to ask Belinda Fine to share some of her takeaways about what makes a successful partnership between funders and grantees. Just to let you know, we'll be happy to email you a copy of the study after this call so you have the takeaways for reference. But in the meantime, Melinda, can you please fill us in?
Sure. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you, Melinda.
Good. I never trust these things. Thank you. Okay. Good afternoon. Thank you so much for letting me join you. I am with TCC. I direct our philanthropy practice here. We've been around the block for about 40 years. And we collaborate with foundations and nonprofits in many ways, strategy, evaluation, funder learning. And in that context, we had the wonderful opportunity to partner with the William Penn Foundation in its support of both the Campaign for Fair Education Funding and the Pre-K for Pennsylvania campaign. And it was out of that work that involved our being an embedded evaluator that we also did some research talking to foundations around the country who support advocacy, as well as talking to community organizers and advocacy groups around what their experience is of what makes for good process between foundations and advocates in driving campaigns. And that knowledge went into this report that was referenced. I would say also that many of the funders and the organizations that we spoke to were members of a collaborative fund that I used to run called the Communities for Public Education Reform, or CPER Fund, that I was the director of, which funded in Pennsylvania, among other places across the country. And so the wisdom of that education-focused fund, which involved several of you all, is also infused throughout this report that you'll receive. So my charge, I think up until 2020, correct me if I'm wrong, folks that are running the call, is to provide overall context about what works, and I'm going to speak at a high altitude level, and I want to comment on three things: why funders should support or do support advocacy overall, what effective approaches are that would have been identified, and then if there's time, I'll just close with a couple overall lessons to keep in mind. I am aware that I've had many cups of coffee today, and I'm probably speaking very fast, so am I speaking too fast for you all to follow, or is this okay?
I think that sounds good. I'm following you.
Great. Okay, so why do foundations tell us that they fund advocacy? There are many reasons, two up top that I want to flag. One is simply, most importantly, that it's a way to ensure sustained and maximal impact. You know, advocacy campaigns are about achieving systemic solutions in policy. So today we're talking about education. Funders who want to be ensuring equitable and high-quality education for all children and youth may well choose to support research or curricular development or professional development or any other number of important strategies to make change. But for those elements to hold, they will need to ultimately be grounded in policy on various levels to undergird them. And advocacy and community organizing, sort of enveloped within a broader definition of advocacy that I think we're using today, is the go-to choice for funders looking to support systemic long-term change. It may not be the only focus in a foundation's toolkit, but it is simply one more avenue. I think a second critical reason is that really fundamentally it's a way to nurture democracy. Advocacy campaigns involve mobilizing or organizing people, often who are left out of public discussions. You certainly see that in terms of who the agents are in some of the campaigns that you'll talk about today. And so supporting advocacy can be a lever for building community muscle, if you will, and civic participation that has the potential to outlast particular campaigns. So moving into strategies, there are lots of different strategies that are effective. As with any strategic choice, the foundation needs to choose those that best align with its values and comfortable and customary approaches within the realm of grant making, which is the overall strategy that, of course, all foundations use. Key pieces to keep in mind when one is specifically looking at supporting advocacy campaigns. First of all, that grant-making support can either go to individual organizations within a campaign or indirectly to campaigns as a whole more holistically so that a number of organizations indirectly end up getting support. But regardless of where the funding lands, strategies that are effective are, first, providing unrestricted funding. Arguably, all organizations that funders support for any purposes like to get general operating support. I realize that. But particularly for advocacy campaigns, supporting the capacity to meet operational logistics is essential, since these are always multi-partner efforts that are really complicated and require substantial resources that program-focused support just doesn't allow. A second piece is to provide flexible or rapid response funding. You know, of course, the limitation of program-focused funding is that it requires being clear from the get-go about what one's going to do. The reality of advocacy campaigns is that things are always changing, and so there needs to be some mechanism for funding to be responsive to changing political winds that groups that are advancing campaigns must respond to in order to be effective. A third is multi-year grants. You know, it is very rare that campaigns can be achieved within an annual 12-month grant cycle. So thinking about the timeline for support stretching over a campaign's life cycle rather than the funder's standard 12-month period is very important. Whether that is repeated annual grants or often more helpful to grantee organizations or campaigns, multi-year funding, you know, can all be figured out in terms of what a particular foundation is able to do in terms of how its funding is structured. But thinking of funding over the longer term of a campaign in a multi-year fashion is critical. And then the last, I would say, grant-making piece to just lift up is that typically funders support advocacy work focusing on a campaign when it is in motion and stop their funding once a win has been achieved. And again one hears from advocates that continuing support so that advocacy groups have the capacity to monitor implementation of wins achieved and ensure they're accountably moving forward is critical as well. So those are a cluster of ways to think about important ways to do grant making when the target is for advocacy as opposed to other ends. A second strategy overall is to really just think about using all the tools in a funder's toolbox beyond making grants. So complementary supports that are particularly helpful for advocacy purposes might involve allocating resources to convening members of campaigns so that they have an ability to strategize and plan together. Networking campaign advocates with funder peers to help them diversify their resources is another approach. Building the capacity either of individual organizations to function more effectively or to the cohorts of groups that are working together in a campaign is almost always critically needed. Often, capacity building supports for strategic communication, fundraising, evaluation, and policy research are the kinds of capacity supports that campaign advocates most need. And last, using the funder bully pulpit to advocate for the policy target alongside the advocates that are being supported is also a critical approach. I'd say the last overall strategy just to mention is collaborative funding. This is an approach nearest and dearest to my own heart as a former director of a collaborative fund. The value for supporting advocacy campaigns in particular, there are several. Obviously, first and foremost, it increases a resource pool. When problems are big enough to require substantial policy change, they're too big for any individual foundation to solve them alone. It also is a way to minimize risk. Funders who are less comfortable tackling policy may find safety in numbers with their funder peers. It can also be a way to expand the array of services that are provided to campaigns. So while some funders may exclusively need to do their work through grant making alone, some of these other complementary supports that I mentioned a moment ago may be possible for other funders that are within a collaborative structure. And last, of course, it increases opportunities for learning for funders themselves, both from their funder peers and from the networks that those funders also bring to the table. So I've got one more minute. Let me just close with overall things I think we've been heard again and again from foundations to keep in mind. The first is that change takes a while to achieve, and the successes of a campaign are obviously only partly dependent on grantees of a foundation doing their very best work. So by definition, this requires a longer timeline for funding in which to realize results. Implications are to be patient in waiting for successes, to anticipate that campaigns will have failures and setbacks, to expect reasonable indicators of progress from campaign advocates, and, you know, ideally to sustain funding over time. Second aha is that, this is not going to sound like so much of an aha in this political moment, but things change. And campaigns that are going really well in one policy context may look entirely differently when that policy context shifts. This is an embarrassingly obvious statement today in light of our administration changes. But campaigns then need ways to pivot and be able to be responsive to both new challenges and opportunities to seize. So rapid response funding, flexible funding, resourcing grantees to come together and collaborate and think and envision what needs to happen is critical. And let me just close here then on this theme of collaboration. I would argue from everything I've seen, both through this research and my own prior experience as a funder doing this work, that supporting advocacy really entails developing a different kind of relationships with one's grantees, one that embraces uncertainty and risk, that recognizes that outcomes are dependent on multiple variables, often beyond the funder or grantee's control, and it requires a certain kind of openness and trust and partnership to do this work well. So with that very quick run-through, I am so eager to hear how the funders on the phone have thought about this work, what, if anything, resonates in what I've said, and I will turn it back to you all for the next person and hopefully correctly put myself back on mute.
Thank you so much, Melinda. We want to ask Joan Benso, who's president and CEO of Pennsylvania Partnerships for Children, to respond just quickly to what Melinda has shared with us. Most of you know that Pennsylvania Partnerships for Children is a statewide children's advocacy organization which advances policies that improve the health, education, and well-being of Pennsylvania's children. So, Joan, please tell us what, in your experience, has contributed to the most fruitful and least fruitful relationships between advocacy organizations and funders. What kind of guidance would you give?
Sure. Thank you, Barbara. And thank you, Melinda. First, just a little bit on terminology. Melinda's talking about campaigns, which feel like big concepts, you know, big multi-year efforts. And I think many of her lessons learned could apply to a local small initiative. They could apply to a long-standing coalition. So I would urge you to just think about many terms rather than just focusing on a campaign, which for some funders could sound pretty intimidating to be part of. Obviously, funder collaboratives help funders of all sizes get involved in big efforts, but small ones are important too. I guess when we talk about relationships between funders and grantees that are successful, the same elements that go into any personal relationship are the core elements: honesty, mutual respect, trust, and an open dialogue. Now, as a grantee, if you're a new funder for me, or even a new grant officer and a long-term funder, the early days of those relationships we all know can be a bit of a challenge. I'm in the sales business then. I'm trying to sell the value add of my organization and my strategy, and you're trying to figure out how I fit in. But the best relationships we've been in long-term is when both funder and grantee take responsibility for building a much more deep relationship. I would urge funders to always encourage candor. It's very hard for grantees to tell funders when they feel like something they've tried is not successful or they can't get done what they've agreed to do. But I've never had that experience and have a funder do anything other than understand and help me problem solve. I think there's a real opportunity for funders to understand whose expertise is matched, you know, fits the bill at that moment. Often as advocates, we come to the table with sometimes years of professional experience running campaigns, and we're working with grant officers that sometimes have never been involved in advocacy either personally or professionally. So I think when the funder thinks about shifting the roles a little bit, you have the higher role in hierarchical order to helping advocates feel like they're the expert, really opens the door in a really important way, especially in that new relationship. So maybe reflecting upon something another funder told you about this organization, or simply just looking at our websites and reflecting on a piece of what apparently looks like successful work. Our best relationships are with funders that go long and far and much deeper than annual applications and grant reports. And when both I make time and the funder makes time to be in touch with each other, regularly check in on progress made, which builds the relationships and allows to open the door for things we're really struggling with. We have some funders that have set up processes to routinely call grantees and say to them, so how's it going? What else can I help you with? What are you really proud of? What are you struggling with? We're all really busy, but I would suggest that that's something that's worked really, really well for us. Another successful model we've had is with grant officers that are trying to figure out how to sell the idea of advocacy within their own organization. So whether they're selling it to more senior staff or their board, and asking the advocate to help make the strongest case they possibly can. Again, it puts the relationship on a little bit more of a level playing field. I would also caution funders that are supporting multiple grantees either through one campaign or through a line strategy. Sometimes those campaign structures, that this is the case, for example, in the Campaign for Fair Education Funding, where we have a fiscal agent and a steering committee and a chair and a campaign manager, that at times individual grantees can feel like they can't be in touch. Making it very clear that you're welcome to be in touch at any time, regardless of where you sit in that organizational pecking order. That delightful question that all the funders on the phone that I spoke with beforehand that I value my relationship with asked me to answer: what makes a not successful relationship with a funder? Thanks so much for everyone for asking that one. Well, I will say it has nothing to do with anyone on the phone, but I have experienced at times where a funder will come to us and offer us a body of funds to do a body of work, implement a strategy around an issue-based campaign or an issue-based coalition that they've decided is the right strategy. And sometimes you don't think that strategy makes a lot of sense. But you're in that delicate situation of potentially telling that funder, gee, I don't think that's a really good idea. So I want you guys to tell me how I better manage my side of that conversation. But what I would say is, you know, when you've got concepts for strategy, and some of you have, you know, very well-developed advocacy skills of your own, that you sort of go to a grantee asking them what might be the value add of such and that strategy in the campaign they're working in, because sometimes they have good reason why they think it wouldn't be. But it's very hard to say no to you because you worry about what happens moving forward. I'd also urge you as grantors to think about relationships with other funders who have significant professional experience in advocacy. I find oftentimes that funders come from other sectors, direct service, finance, development, but I've not met many in my career that bring sort of a big portfolio of their own independent advocacy efforts, having led an organization or a campaign. We all now have the benefit of Michelle Figler, who's had every seat imaginable in the early learning world now, at the funder table. And so I would turn to my friend Michelle and urge you all to talk to her as a great resource on how it feels to sit in either seat and what could be effective. And lastly, I would remind you that any way you might invest in advocacy is a helpful way to invest. We clearly value large, multi-year general support grants that allow our organization to stay in business and be poised for issue-based campaigns. And we very much support, you know, and value project-based support that allows us to pivot and go deep somewhere. But we wouldn't be in business without those $5,000 and $10,000 and $15,000 smaller grants that can tend to come from small family and regional foundations that often allow us to do some small place-based strategy that's very additive. So I wouldn't be intimidated again by the big framework of some multi-million-dollar statewide advocacy campaign. There's a way for everybody to play. Thanks, Barb.
Joan, thank you very much. I appreciate your calling out the point that this work can be done at any level, at both a very local community level to a much more universal statewide level. At this point, we want to turn to our colleagues who are supporting statewide advocacy efforts. I'm going to ask each of them to describe one of these three campaigns very briefly, and remember those who have called in that you'll find links to information about each one in the email we sent previously. And we're going to try to highlight what each funder has found most effective and most challenging about supporting this kind of work. We'll spend about 10 minutes on each of these three efforts and then have time for Q&A at the end. So our first speaker is Elliot Weinbaum, who is with William Penn Foundation. And Elliot, let me start by asking you to just briefly tell us about the Campaign for Fair Education Funding. If you could give us a brief introduction, how and why it was formed, and a snapshot of who the members are and its goals.
Sure. Thanks so much, Barb. So the Campaign for Fair Education Funding has the mission of seeing Pennsylvania adopt and maintain an adequate and equitable system of funding for public education. It is a campaign of more than 50 organizations around the state representing a diverse group of stakeholders. In terms, we have religious organizations, rural and small schools, large urban schools, professional organizations, child advocacy organizations, and a whole range of groups. The campaign really began to be formed early in 2014, initially spearheaded by Pennsylvania Partnerships for Children and Education Law Center of Pennsylvania, working with the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center, Public Citizens for Children and Youth, Education Voters, Power, and Research for Action, who all came together to do some planning about how they could work collaboratively on this issue. It was following a period of very significant cuts in state funding, recognizing that Pennsylvania had lower, the state was making a lower than average contribution, that we had some of the largest funding gaps in the country in terms of between rich and poor districts, that there were many districts that were moving closer and closer to the brink of insolvency, financially insolvent, and that there was no funding formula that would permit the allocation of any additional funds in a rational way that was really connected with the enrollment and needs of students in districts across Pennsylvania. So those groups kind of came together, did some planning, and then created, as I say, this Campaign for Fair Education Funding. Folks can certainly see more about it at fairfundingpa.org. But that's a bit of the history and origin of this campaign. Obviously, it builds on lots and lots of work that many of the participating organizations have been doing in Pennsylvania around improving educational opportunities for kids over decades. But this sort of manifestation and coordinated, very targeted campaign began in 2014.
Great, thank you. Can you fill us in a little bit on how funders should think about the sometimes political dimension of advocacy? How did the William Penn Foundation and other funders think about that? And was funding this perceived as risky in some way? And if it was, did the foundation take any steps to kind of minimize the risk or perceived risk?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about that, and certainly my fellow funders on the phone may have different perspectives. For us, this is very much an effort about educating the public and legislators and helping the public to educate their legislators on issues that are in some ways simple and fundamental but may not be getting a lot of attention. How much money is your district raising? How much money is your district spending? How is the money in your district related to the number of kids in your district and the needs that those kids may have? But there are also very complicated issues. How does a funding formula work and what should be included in it? How can you measure the equity of a funding system statewide? What are the implications for funding shortfalls? The economic impacts of underinvestment in education. These are all issues that are actually very important to sort of typical citizens and legislators, but very hard to access if there's not an entity there to provide them with the information in digestible ways that make it very applicable to their specific context. And that, for us, is very much the role of advocacy organizations, that they reach out to communities across the state and help to inform and educate and empower them about issues that are important to them. So for us, you know, it's not so much political, it's about the facts, right? And when an advocacy organization presents to a legislator that in Pennsylvania, the wealthiest quarter of districts spend $78,000 more per classroom than districts in the poorest quarter, that's important to legislators who really do want to pursue opportunity for their citizens. And for many legislators, they may be representing districts in both of those categories. I think many are aware that Pennsylvania spends lots of money on public education, and our basic education funding is close to $6 billion, which does put Pennsylvania at the upper end of education spending. But not many people know that Pennsylvania has the third largest achievement gap between white and Latino students in the whole country, or the sixth largest gap between white and African-American students, which would suggest that while we're spending a lot of money, we are terribly underserving a lot of our citizens. And that's important, as I say, to voters across the state as well as to legislators. So advocacy campaigns help people understand this information. The Campaign for Fair Education Funding, for example, has a fact sheet for every single school district in Pennsylvania so that residents and legislators can go on and see what the implications of funding shifts have been for their own districts. So that is very much how we understand this work and how we've seen it roll out, that when people have their attention drawn to these important issues, they are, in fact, activated to take part and exercise their democratic process. In terms of other risks, you know, we at the foundation, we don't fund lobbying, and so we have, for example, supported the Alliance for Justice to do some training for advocacy organizations to help them stay on the right side of the regulations related to funding sources and lobbying rules and registrations, et cetera. And so Alliance for Justice has done some of that, and their resources, including those that are freely available on the web, as well as some that have been customized to help advocates in Pennsylvania, is a resource that we made available. All of the organizations in the campaign that, certainly the ones we fund, have funding from multiple sources for this work. And so to Melinda's point earlier, that is a risk mitigant to some extent, that there are multiple sources contributing to the advocacy work. So those are a couple of steps that we've taken to reduce the risk. I would say that for some and for our board, perhaps the biggest concern is really about investing foundation funds and not having the impact that you desire. And that is certainly a risk and a concern. But we have mitigated that. Well, first of all, we've seen a good track record of the campaign in terms of the creation and adoption of a funding formula. It was signed into law last year, and also increased funding. So not only is there more funding, that new funding is being allocated in a more rational way. So we have a bit of a track record already in terms of the impact. But we also have something else that I think Melinda alluded to earlier, certainly mentioned in the report that she wrote, which is a very clear sort of work plan and logic model that demonstrates the accomplishments of the campaign as they happen. So not everything necessarily results in a policy change or a big win like the ones I just described, but there are smaller wins along the way in terms of the outreach and education that's done by organizations that that are important to sort of capture and convey to stakeholders.
Elliot, thank you so much. I wanted at this point to ask Joan to talk a little bit about the Campaign for Fair Education funding, and given that it's a very large entity with lots and lots of partners, more than 50 partners, how did the group ensure that the right organizations and networks were at the table, and how did that group get brought together, and how does it stay together?
Well, I think the place to start that conversation goes back to Elliot's planning grant. When we started in the planning grant phase of this work, we began to, as partners, assess who our relationships were with. And the TCC report, when people see it, will see it speaks to authentically engaging community, which is a very, very important thing to do. You can't build a successful campaign, social change campaign, unless the recipients or the constituents of the services you're speaking of have authentic voice. But sometimes progressives get comfortable in their own space talking with each other, and some of the campaigns that we've been in that have not been as successful is because we failed to do that very important thing, which is stand back and say, so who do we need to influence to win? So if you're working at the state capitol level in Harrisburg, and when the Campaign for Fair Education Funded started, we had a Republican governor and a Republican-controlled legislature. We have a more deeply Republican-controlled legislature now and even more conservative than it had been. And we have a Democrat governor who ran on school funding as an agenda. But what we realized is that, we were trying to fix a problem that was broken in 1992. So to say things take a long time is sort of the understatement when you talk about adequate and equitable funded schools in Pennsylvania. We really determined that we needed a very diverse group of stakeholders, and we needed to engage the business community in the school funding debate in a way they had never been engaged. So those of us who had worked with them in other issue areas or had board members from the business community began to outreach to those organizations and other, more, I don't want to say necessarily, moderately leaning education reform groups. When the coalition first came together, and it was not yet a campaign, I use that term with intentionality, instead of developing an ask, we developed a set of principles. So really what we focused on are what are the shared values we all have for our kids in public schools in Pennsylvania. And that allowed us to really ID some of the issues that people would be on opposite sides of. You could name them easily yourselves. pension reform, teacher accountability. And in the end, we decided charter school reform. We decided that it was important to jettison some of those issues and keep the players who disagreed with each other in the room. And we're very proud of that work. It's been hard. We've seen some groups come and go. And we use a leadership structure that, with great intentionality through committees and a steering committee, has been representative of those diverse points of view. Now, that also has given us access to the most powerful players in the state capitol, including very conservative Republican leaders. I think moving ahead and the lesson learned for us is that it's sort of that one-on-one work, figuring out who trusts who in the room when you're as big as 50 organizations, so you can do that one-on-one outreach. We do that outreach with a campaign director, but we also do it with individual members, whether they be in leadership. I serve as the campaign's chair. It's not always me that goes and has that conversation, but we figure out who the best person to talk to the group is that's struggling at the moment. See, everything the leadership structure does is it allows us to sort of self-police. Sometimes organizations engage in strategies that other groups in the campaign aren't comfortable in, and it's really important for a management structure to figure out which of those activities can happen in the name of the campaign and which have to be pushed off and run individually by groups. It's mostly just a lot of hard work.
Thank you very much. Surprise, it's a lot of hard work. Let's move on. Unfortunately, we have learned Michelle Figler has a last-minute conflict, but I want to ask Stan Thompson at the Heinz Endowments if you could describe a brief overview of pre-K for PA and how it builds on or extends the Heinz Endowment's prior work in funding advocacy in the field of early education.
Good afternoon, Barbara, and everyone else on the line. I'd like to tweak the question a little bit. I think that Joan Benzo and Kristen Burns are probably better positioned to talk about pre-K for Pennsylvania than I am, given my focus, which has been pretty much K through 12 education as the director for the education program at the endowments. There are certain overlaps that that do occur, and I think one of the things that we have seen happen is the need for a focus on what things have been happening around the county in addition to being part of that larger coalition that, that Joan had alluded to, that Elliot had alluded to. We find ourselves facing problems here in Allegheny County and in the region that really have to do with children's services and, you know, with unemployment, lack of affordable housing, hunger that's still at historical high levels. You know, as well as children's well-being being in jeopardy, we have found that children are really in a position where they are they're really the poorest age group if you look at the data, and this has been something that we have seen particularly as the case for children of color. And we know that here in our area that these challenges have not gone away. If anything, we at the endowments, as well as the Pittsburgh and Grable Foundations, as well as the United Way, wanted to be able to address this in a concerted way. So in 2013, there was an opportunity to provide startup funds to establish a local advocacy organization now known as Allies for Children. And incidentally, Allies for Children is part of the Campaign for Fair Education funding, and it's through their leadership that Southwestern Pennsylvania has been able to play a significant role in that campaign. Some of the wins locally that have happened as a result of the launch for Allies for Children. We've seen the reduction in the percentage of uninsured children and families in the city. There has been the spearheading of a coalition that brought $200,000 in grant dollars to implement a plan called Healthy Together. And I had alluded to the Campaign for Fair Education funding. Through the through Allies for Children, their involvement, we've been able to see recruitment and mobilization of both grass tops and grassroots supporters from various constituencies here in southwestern Pennsylvania advocate for the campaign. We've also seen a reinforcement of work across statewide organizations to provide the platform for the campaign and supporting really the mobilization and community engagement strategies and their activities specifically for individuals at this end of the state. There had been some mention earlier of things that have happened as a result of the Pennsylvania Early Learning Investment Commission and the focus on the campaign. Consequently, for Pittsburgh Public Schools, because of allocated funding, there were 200 additional children who are being served now in pre-K, and up to, I should say, they're now serving more than 600 out of 2,000 who are eligible for pre-K in the city. This would not have happened through the efforts of the campaign and those investments. So, you know, some of the things that Joan and Elliot have talked about, the collaboration, the shared values of organizations across the state, the fact that people were able to establish these non-negotiables and focus on these things that were really going to have an impact on children across the state has really been the power behind this and has caused the endowments as well as other foundations here at the west end of the state, southwestern end of the state, to want to be a part of this powerful campaign as well as, you know, really make its mark, have an impact on doing what we can do for kids and families.
Dan, thank you so much. It's certainly a powerful statement that there are some hundreds of children who are being served now who would not otherwise have been served. I think in the interest of time, what I'd like to do is go to Kristen Burns at the Grable Foundation so that we hear about the Pennsylvania Early Learning Investment Commission. And again, if people are interested in finding out more about Pre-K for PA, to have a look at the website. So, Kristen, can you fill us in with some background?
Sure, happy to. Thanks, Barb, and good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for having me. I'll just reiterate what Barb said. I mean, I and many of the funders on this call have been involved both with Pre-K for PA as well as with these other efforts, and so if in the question and answer period, which I'll try to leave ample time for, you have questions about that, feel free to ask. But I'll jump right into the Early Learning Investment Commission story because I think that's a little bit different than what we've heard so far. It's not a campaign per se. The commission, or ELIC, as we affectionately call it, was created in 2008 through an executive order by the governor with the purpose of securing public investment in early learning, not only pre-K, but including pre-K, by focusing on practices that were educationally, economically, and scientifically sound, and then by increasing awareness among the public, among the business community, about the importance of high-quality early learning. Where we sit today, there are about 70 commissioners from the business community. These are top C-level executives from businesses around the state, representing right now 28 counties, Republicans and Democrats alike, from rural and urban communities and everywhere in between, representing almost every major industry in the state. And they've all come together to be champions, unexpected champions, really, in many cases, for early learning. They speak to more than 3,000 business leaders each year, their peers and colleagues, through speaking engagements. They conduct many, many legislative visits and receptions and breakfasts for policymakers in Harrisburg and in their home districts. They're responsible for a regular drumbeat of earned media, commissioner-authored op-eds, sometimes some radio and television coverage as well. And then many of them work locally with local groups of business leaders and local funders and providers, not only to increase awareness about the importance of early learning, but also to help build the early learning system. So that's a quick overview.
Great. I know that the Grable Foundation's been involved with advocating for education in Pennsylvania and with Early Learning Investment Commission for some time. Can you tell us about what keeps the foundation engaged in this? At what kind of milestones or events do you look for or your trustees look for that tell you that the investments in advocacy are paying off and that some kind of progress is being made?
Yeah, sure. I mean, some of my colleagues have mentioned already the importance of looking at this as a long-term game, right? These are big changes that take a lot of time, and therefore we believe that we should also be patient investors in this work. But there are signs of progress. You know, when ELIC started, there was still, in many forums, a statewide public policy conversation about whether early learning mattered and whether it was just glorified babysitting. And I'm happy to say I think that's been settled. I think that through the combined efforts of many on this call, and many who aren't on this call too, people now understand that high-quality early learning does make a difference. It is important. And now the conversation has moved on to how do we figure out how to pay for it and how do we prioritize it against the many other valid and important needs in the state. But I view that as progress, that we're no longer trying to convince people that this is worthwhile. We just need to figure out how to elevate it among the priorities. ELIC has been going through a strategic planning process recently, and they found in that process of talking to their stakeholders that many credit ELIC with helping to make early learning a bipartisan issue in the General Assembly. Like I said, if you have a business leader walking into a legislator's office, chances are the legislator is not expecting them to have early learning be the reason they're there. And so many of the commissioners are Republicans and many are from rural conservative areas, and having those champions in those districts kind of catch the attention of policymakers who might not be expecting to hear that particular person championing that particular cause. So we have seen investments, increases in state investment. Of course, we'd like to see more. I don't think this problem has been solved, but I will say that I think those investments are signs of a win during some really tight fiscal time periods. There's more to be done, to be sure, but we're pleased and proud of what's been accomplished so far.
Thank you so much. We're at a point now where we can turn to other folks who are on the call. We've talked about three different kinds of activities, one that would shift how the state allocates its resources in education, and one that would kind of mobilize the state to make significantly higher investments in pre-K, and then the last, which mobilizes business and civic leadership. So all of those are important contributors to making some kind of progress. At this point, we want to open up the call, and my colleague Jenny is going to provide some instructions for how to put your question in.
The instructions should be on the screen now for everyone to see. If you would raise your hand by clicking in the lower left-hand part of your screen, we'll identify those hands raised, then you'll be able to unmute your line by pressing star 7 to ask the question. And we just ask that you press star 6 to remute the line after you ask your question. If you prefer to type a question, you can do that with the chat with presenter box also in the left-hand side of your screen. Your question will be queued, and we'll ask it for you.
While people are thinking about what they might want to ask, I wanted to ask all our presenters about course corrections and how you see setting realistic expectations. I'm sure there have been times when some of these activities have had to change tactics. Have the activities that we've described so far unfolded as you anticipated for the most part, or have there have to be some major swerves? And if you'd like to answer, *7 to unmute, please.
Yeah, I have a couple of examples. This is Elliot. One comes from the Pre-K for PA campaign, which really got started just about the time that the gubernatorial election was getting underway, the most recent one. And so initially it had a strategy that was very much focused on getting this issue of pre-K and statewide support for pre-K in the dialogue related to the campaigns. And I think it did that very successfully with all of the candidates taking a position on pre-K and the leading candidates having quite a forceful position in support of expanded pre-K, including Governor Wolf, who was eventually elected. And so that was a strategy that was right for that time in order to get this issue into the public discourse using, if you will, the coattails of the energy behind a gubernatorial campaign. The Pre-K for PA then had to shift once folks were in office and settling down to figure out which issues they're going to focus on, and not having the kind of constant coverage that a campaign generates in the media to figure out new ways to bring this issue to the attention of the general public and to legislators. And so they made that shift in a relatively deft fashion. It had implications for how the Pre-K for PA campaign itself was managed and shifted away from a central campaign manager to a sort of governance structure really led by the advocacy organizations involved. So that shift happened. And a second example I would bring to people's attention is related to the Campaign for Fair Education funding, where it became apparent that a broader diversity of voices was needed in the campaign, whether that is based on geography or demographics. And so in more recent funding, the foundation helped to create a fund called Investing Together for Pennsylvania Students, which is housed at the New Venture Fund and is really a pooled funder collaborative that seeks to elevate underrepresented voices enabling them to take part in the campaign. And that's just an example of also making it easier for lots of funders to collaborate through that fund, which is housed at New Venture Fund, as I say, but can accept grants of any size and then has a steering committee that decides how to allocate that funding in ways aligned with the Campaign for Fair Education funding, but specifically prioritizing voices that aren't yet represented.
Great. Stan, Kristen, anything to add?
I can jump in about the Early Learning Investment Commission. So at its inception, early learning covers a lot of territory, right? I mean, there's pre-K, there's child care, there's early intervention, there's home visiting. There are a number of things that can be considered part of early learning. And ELIC really began with at least a practical focus, maybe not a stated focus, but a practical focus on pre-K. And now they still care deeply about pre-K and will continue to advocate for pre-K, but they're also thinking about how maybe to roll some of those other topics into their advocacy work, thinking about how to advocate for high-quality child care for infants and toddlers, for example, or to expand funding for home visiting programs that are evidence-based and proven to be effective. So that involves all kinds of things from, thinking about how to make sure that the commissioners are well informed about all of those topics and thinking about what the approach should be on these, closely related but still different tactical angles that they might be pursuing. So that's been a shift that continues to be underway for ELIC.
Great. Thank you so much. Just very quickly, I wanted to ask about how the three funding organizations have maintained your relationships. You all three are invested in these various activities at various levels of support. And what final words would you have about what makes funding partnerships work well?
This is Stan Thompson. One of the things that I was just extremely delighted with was the fact that Elliot was able to reach out to to me and essentially say, here are some things that, we're doing. You may not be aware of the work that we're investing in. Here's the rationale for why we're doing it. We really see the value behind this. We would like to make this a statewide initiative. There are some things that we know fall under your bailiwick, being a regional foundation, primarily focusing on southwestern Pennsylvania, but we think we have an opportunity here to collaborate in a way that could have some very powerful results across the state. And I think that when Elliot was able to go ahead and exercise that kind of professional courage, you know, it was something that I saw as possibly having a win-win situation and certainly having an impact that, you know, was going to be statewide. It's nice to be able to have folks kind of serve as a provocateur. And I think in this particular case, I think that William Penn had offered an opportunity to the Heinz Endowments and certainly to those organizations here, which were part of the 50 that were involved in this conversation. And, you know, as a result of that, we've been able to continue to fund folks at the southwestern part of the state. And this will be the third year in which we're providing funding. And I think the Jones, you know, assessment that when it comes to advocacy, you have to think in terms of being able to say, all right, we're going to go ahead and provide some operating dollars, and we're not really going to have a whole lot of strings attached to this work, you know, in terms of programming. We're not going to force you into this kind of mission creep mentality. And I think that because we were able to, again, continue to have these conversations across the state, it provided an opportunity, and I think it provided some good work, knowing that the foundation community could share similar values and could work together to see some statewide initiative begin to take root in a significant way.
If I could just add to what Stan said, I think there's real value in having a coalition of statewide partners and having an effective advocacy strategy. The more that we can speak together as a state rather than as one or two funders from one, you know, part of the state, I think that captures the attention of those we're trying to reach even more effectively.
Thank you both. That's a great point, and I like very much Stan's pointing out that different funders can take different roles, and some of them can be more outward facing than others. But there's a role for everyone. We've come to the end of our time, and I want to thank everyone, Kristen, Stan, Elliot, Melinda, and Joan. Thank you so much for sharing your insights. We're once again going to be forwarding the TCC report to everyone, along with a brief survey, which we hope you'll complete. I also want to let folks know our next call, which will be focused on healthcare, will be on February 23rd at 2 o'clock. We hope you'll join us. And we'd also like to let folks know, if you don't already, that there's a conference being designed right now for policy engagement for Pennsylvania funders of all kinds. The dates are May 1st and 2nd. It will be in Harrisburg. We very much hope you'll hold those dates in your calendar and stay tuned for details about that as well. Thank you very, very much, everyone. We've learned a lot, and we'll look forward to the next call. And in the meantime, have a good afternoon.